You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. You're also listening to A Climate Affair. I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon. We've got a terrific show lined up. It's going to be a lot about climate change for a change because there's just so much activity going on. And to that effect, we've got a terrific guest in our studio, Emma Brindle, who's the Climate Justice Coordinator for Friends of the Earth. Hi, Emma. Welcome.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is Friends of the Earth?
Friends of the Earth is an environment and social justice organisation. We recognise that there is a connection between environmental sustainability and social justice, and we work on a range of different issues. Here in Brisbane, we work on climate justice, which I'll talk more about, peace, anti-nuclear, food irradiation, and that's about it, yeah. We have a lot more national campaigns, but that's what we focus on here in Brisbane.
Because, of course, issues differ depending on where you are, and that's the whole locavore sort of movement, is to keep things even a global perspective but a local emphasis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The campaigns that we work on here in Brisbane are actually ones that are national campaigns as well, but in some of the other Friends of the Earth around the country, they focus on more local campaigns, like forest issues and so on, that are local to those groups.
So social impact of environmental issues is incredibly important but often sort of neglected when people talk about environmental issues. Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I think people have tended to see the environment as something that is separate from us. There's us and there's the environment, as if we're not actually part of the environment. And that has kind of been the discourse around environmentalism for some years now, and still does exist to a certain extent. It might be starting to change, particularly with climate change, where people are seeing how the impacts will be affecting people and how what we do particularly affects the environment as well. But, you know, every environmental issue has a social element to it, and we need to see ourselves as being part of those issues rather than separate from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the campaigns you're working on at the moment is something called Climate Refugees. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what that means.
So climate refugees are people who have been displaced as a result of the impacts of climate change, which could be desertification, rising sea levels, flooding, extreme weather events, such as bushfires and so on.
Is the tsunami in Bali an example?
That would actually be... So there are actually two terms that we use. One is environmental refugees and the other is climate refugees. When we use environmental refugees, we're talking about people who are displaced for any environmental reason, whereas climate refugees, we're talking about climate change refugees. So the tsunami was not actually related to climate change. However, that is also that is a case of people being displaced due to environmental reasons. So we could certainly say that they are environmental reasons, and they are environmental refugees, sorry. And we're seeing increasing numbers of environmental refugees around the world.
Yes, and certainly with the tsunami, people view that as it was a terrible and awful tragedy. But the difference, I suppose, is that the climate refugees, we foresee consistent degradation of these landscapes, whereas the tsunami we take as a catastrophic but perhaps a one-time or at least a very infrequent event. And so you want to consider the legal cases very differently for these different refugees. One might be to be helping people re-establish in areas, and in other places, I mean, if people can't even live there anymore, then it's sort of an end of the story there for human survival in these places.
That's right. But climate refugees, I guess it's much more unheard of because the changes aren't so obvious. You know, everyone knows when the tsunami happens and we see images of what occurs and what happens to people in those situations. Whereas climate change, it's a more gradual process, and so we don't see what's happening, but the reality is that people are already being displaced from their homes as a result of the impacts of climate change, and we're seeing this in the Pacific and in Africa as well already.
And certainly Australia is located within that Pacific area, so we have a particular interest, I imagine, in helping and being very active with those Pacific Islanders. Tell us something bit more, you know, specific maybe, what actual countries are suffering in this sort of climate change environment?
Well, in our local region, Tuvalu is the most vulnerable country to sea level rise. Tuvalu is a tiny little nation, which is the total area is 26 square kilometres, and the highest point above sea level is only 4.5 metres. So it's an absolutely tiny, tiny place, with a population of 11,000 people, and they're already suffering the impacts of climate change impacts. Their crop gardens are being polluted by salt water and water shortage, and so on. But there's also another range of Pacific nations. There's Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, and at the moment, people in the Carteret Islands in Papua New Guinea are just about to be relocated. As a result of both rising sea levels related to climate change and of geological movement, it's an issue where both factors are compounding each other and making their islands uninhabitable.
It's amazing. Those countries that you've mentioned, most of our listeners, I don't think, will have even heard of them, let alone know that they're in crisis. Perhaps this is a testament to our culture, where we tend to only know the islands where they've got expensive holidays going for them, and we're not actually that involved in the cultures that actually directly surround Australia. So why is the media ignoring these people? I mean, the Solomon Islands just had their earthquake, and awful for them, absolute devastation. Amazingly enough, with the geological movement, their islands have moved up 3 metres, which is, if you believed in God and thought there could be God's intervention, you might say, well, we need a little bit of movement up in order to keep the culture to survive. But these other islands are obviously not so lucky, and as you were saying, they've already started plans to move people in Papua New Guinea, you were saying.
Yeah, that's right. And that's an interesting point that you make about people not knowing these countries, because, in fact, two of these nations, at least, Tuvalu and Kiribati, they know a lot about Australia. They actually use the Australian dollar, which is quite amazing to me. They know all about us. We're the big neighbour in the region, and we know virtually nothing about them. Which is a great shame, I think, because they are really rich and interesting cultures. There are other nations, of course, that we know more about, say Vanuatu, which are being impacted upon. And in Vanuatu, there have also been cases of people relocating their villages to higher ground. So it's virtually all of the Pacific Islands, and some of those we hear about and some of those we don't. And yes, it is already happening. The people of the Carteret Islands in Papua New Guinea are about to be evacuated or permanently relocated to Bougainville by the Bougainville government. And they have no outside support for doing this, providing funding and so on. So, of course, their government doesn't have a whole lot of funding to be able to do this. And we're going to see a lot more of this in future. So we really think that we need to be directing some money towards doing this.
And look, I'm a bit ignorant about this policy, and you might be as well, but I thought I'd ask. Now, the Howard government, right, has an abominable record in terms of dealing with boat people trying to come to Australia from across the world. And one of the things that Australia has done is to reject these people and then send sort of colonies onto Pacific Islands and paying islands like Nauru to host prisoners, really, of the Australian government. Are they still there? And if they are still there and the islands are going under because of climate change, is it the Australian government's responsibility to then rehabilitate those people into Australia? I mean,
yeah, that's an interesting thought, actually. Yeah, well, as far as I know, those islands are still doing fine. But, yeah, who knows 50 years down the track what they'll be doing. Of course, the Howard government hasn't been interested at all in the issue of climate refugees, and, in fact, has twice denied the Tuvalu government a request to take in the inhabitants of their country in the event that they should all have to move.
It's such a small population. I mean, we're talking 11,000 people. This is nothing. This is peanuts, even for a country like ours who does. We do have resource problems. We've got terrible water issues. I can understand people being concerned about how many millions of people we can sustain on this land. But 11,000. That's nothing.
Oh, that's right. And actually, they asked both the New Zealand government and the Australian government to take half each. And the Australian government said no, and the New Zealand government said yes. And actually, in response, the New Zealand government has set up a program called the Pacific Access Category, whereby they take a number of people in each year from Fiji, Tonga, Kiribati and Tuvalu, which are some of the most vulnerable nations. However, it does actually exclude the old and the unskilled, and people have to have a certain level of English and have a job offer already to be primary qualify as primary applicants for this program.
Wow, so that's one way to get rid of the population that you don't care about, isn't it? You know, what are they supposed to do? The poor people and the elderly, these people are not trying to leave their island because of some, you know, non-relevant issue. It's that they actually can't survive. Their farms are going underwater.
That's right, yeah. Now, it is possible for them to come with families, but, of course, the principal applicant has to prove that they'll be earning enough money to be able to provide for all of the people, their dependents that they bring with them. So perhaps they can come, but yeah, it is exclusionary. They cannot be principal applicants. So what we're seeing is, from the New Zealand government, a step in the right direction, and they do recognise that it is an issue, and that we have a responsibility to these people. Here in Australia, we have one of the highest levels of greenhouse gas emissions in the world.
Per capita.
And in comparison to Pacific Island nations, where their emissions are very low. So we think, you know, it's the absolute least we can do to accept these climate refugees in our country. So what New Zealand is doing is absolutely a step in the right direction, but it certainly could be done better, and we'd like to see that in Australia.
So your perspective is Australia needs to take responsibility for their contribution to the destruction of these lands, and we know that these carbon outputs are directly relating to human-caused climate change and global warming and the seas rising, and the government's got to take responsibility. And if they want to not have as many refugees, then, hey, maybe we should actually implement the sort of emissions curbing suggestions that all the other major governments of the world besides the United States are advocating.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this must absolutely go hand in hand with any sort of response to climate refugees. Yeah, dealing with the causes of the problem is essential. And it's quite mad that our government has not started to take the steps that are necessary. We're starting to see them change their tune just slightly, but the solutions that are being offered up, nuclear and clean coal, are just not the real solutions to climate change.
What's the problem with nuclear and clean coal?
Well, nuclear, apart from being expensive and extremely dangerous, actually does have a number of greenhouse emissions in its cycle, because you need fossil fuels for the mining of uranium, for the enrichment of uranium, building of the nuclear power plants, decommissioning of the power plants and getting rid of the waste. So even though the emissions are indeed far lower than coal, they do have emissions. They also use a hell of a lot of water, and of course all of the dangers that are associated with nuclear energy.
Wouldn't renewable energy projects also require an enormous amount of fossil fuels in order to implement them, like to build the facilities, like the wind turbines and all of those things? So that particular part of the argument where, oh, look, nuclear reactors require a lot of carbon-based, you know, industry, that's pretty much the same for solar and wind and other at the moment.
Wind, it's actually about on par with wind, actually, and solar photovoltaics are actually higher, the greenhouse emissions per unit of energy produced, but the technology is getting better all the time. And solar thermal technology, I don't know whether you've heard of that or not, it's a new technology. The CSIRO did a report on it about a year and a half ago, which was not published, which said that we'd need only an area 35 square kilometres across in the middle of Australia to provide for all of Australia's energy needs, which is just phenomenal.
That's outrageous for a country that has so many square kilometres. Like, we've got deserts big enough, you know, we've got stable geology in the middle of the land. That would be amazing.
That's right. But the thing is that this report was not published. It was, yeah, it was not in the Howard government's interest to have this report published. And, so it wasn't, although it is possible to get a hold of it. So,
wow. And on that note, a very exciting conspiracy of the Howard government, yet another one. Let's have a quick music break. Planet Radio 88 FM. You're listening to A Climate Affair. I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon, and I'm talking to Emma Brindle, who's the Climate Justice Coordinator for Friends of the Earth. Welcome back, Emma.
Thanks, Kate.
So we just were talking about this idea of solar thermal energy and the fact that there's a CSIRO report that was not published about this information. Tell us a little bit more about it. How does it work?
Solar thermal is different to photovoltaics in that it uses heat rather than light. And basically it uses a whole bunch of mirrors which reflect light into a central point, which creates really, really high temperatures, and then the energy is created from there. That's about my knowledge of solar thermal, I'm afraid. I'm not hugely knowledgeable about the area.
Well, that's all right.
But per unit of energy produced, greenhouse emissions are much lower than photovoltaics, and it has huge potential. As I said before, it's only 35 square kilometres across that land that would be required to provide all of Australia's energy needs.
It would just be incredible. And there are these developments coming from every corner of Australia at the moment. I mean, there's been scientists working on these projects for many, many years, and it seems like only now they're getting some real support and some real funding. I mean, the federal government's putting in hundreds of millions of dollars into geothermal energy to try and get some base rate energy, and they're also throwing money at the coal industries to try and do clean coal. You said you're against clean coal as well. What's the problem with clean coal technology?
Well, the main problem with clean coal technology is that it's actually unproven on a commercial scale. And if it is proven, it's at least 15 years off. We actually need solutions that will reduce our emissions right now. We don't have 15 years up our sleeve. But on top of that, it's also quite dangerous. We don't know if it will actually work. And it's very energy intensive. So if it doesn't work, we're actually creating a lot more emissions than we would have otherwise.
So even in the process of trying to make coal cleaner with their emissions, we're going to need energy, which is, if it's going to come from coal, is going to have the kind of cycle of carbon emissions is the point here, is it?
Yeah, that's right. And also, I just want to make the point that the federal government has been putting huge amounts of money into this in comparison to renewable energies. They have a low emissions technology fund, of which $410 million has been committed, and the vast majority of that is going to clean coal technology. Yeah. So Any renewable energy projects that are happening are really tokenistic in Friends of the Earth's view, and really this funding needs to be directed into renewable energy, which are the real solutions to climate change.
Yeah, as you're saying, or any of the nuclear or clean coal technologies, even if you thought that they were feasible 20 years from now, that's 20 years from now, and we need to do something right now, immediately.
Absolutely.
To curb climate change. Terrific. So our audience, you know, are concerned citizens. They want to know what they can do for to help this climate change crisis. What does Friends of the Earth want us to do? What should we do? Well, how can we help?
Oh, there's so many different things you can do. Of course, you know, all those things that you can do in your own house and in your own lives are really important. Buying locally, reducing your meat consumption, buying secondhand, holidaying locally.
And we live in Queensland, after all. We are living in the holiday state.
So absolutely.
Why would we ever fly to any other tropical paradise when we've got one right here?
Exactly. But equally, if not more important, is the political action that we need to see happen. Even if everyone reduced their own footprint, we still wouldn't be able to see the reduction in emissions that we need. So we really need governmental action. So I would encourage people to become really active, write to your local MP, even meet your local MP if you've got the guts.
Oh, yeah, we've got plenty of guts here in Planet Radio. Come on, get out there, fight.
That's right, and talk to everyone you know, raise awareness about the issues. And what I was talking about before with climate refugees, the ALP has written a discussion paper where they propose accepting climate refugees in Australia. This is only a proposal and we'd really like it to see it become policy. So I'd also recommend people write to their MPs, to Kevin Rudd, to Tony Burke, who's the Shadow Immigration Minister.
Tony Burke, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay, yep.
And encourage them to make these policies into these policy proposals into policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously Labor is working very hard formulating real policies that they can implement when they do come into office after the federal election, which, I mean, you know, Rudd's ratings are through the roof. It seems unlikely that Howard can succeed in this environment. I mean, Australians are changing. They are changing.
Absolutely, they are. Though, unfortunately, Labor has also got their heads stuck down the coal pit.
Well, that's because of the workers. We got a lot of employment there, so...
That's true. 30,000 jobs in the coal industry. But to put it into perspective, 290,000 new jobs were created in Australia last year alone. And, of course, we don't want to see coal workers losing their jobs. But the fact is... by putting coal emissions into the atmosphere, we are destroying the planet and the lives of people around the world. So if we want to avoid this, we are going to have to move away from coal. So I think it's really important that coal workers need to be a part of finding solutions and that we need to have just transition policies so that people who are in the fossil fuel industries can be fairly transitioned into new jobs in the renewable energy sector, perhaps, which can produce huge amounts of jobs.
Totally. And look, let's put this in perspective for a second. I mean, economies shift and change. The top 100 companies today are totally different from the top 100 companies 100 years ago. And there's a lot of families 100 years ago or, you know, 75 years ago who were involved in horse breeding and maintenance because everyone rode horses and had to use horses for transport. And then the cars came in and it was an industry that disappeared. I mean, it just disappeared. The smoking industry is going downhill. People don't want to work for it. They don't want to be associated. They can't go home at night and honestly tell their family that they're proud to be working for cigarette companies. There's no reason why the carbon industry should be any different from any other economic enterprise in the history of economics where they are held accountable for our society and their impact on that society.
Absolutely. And I think Tim Flannery made some analogy to the asbestos industry recently. He was saying, you know, were people worried about, you know, oh, but what about jobs in the asbestos industry when we realised how dangerous it was for our health? And really, this is the coal industry too. It is dangerous for the planet's health, for our children's health. And if we want to see life on Earth continue as it is, then we're going to have to see the end of the coal industry eventually.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Emma. It's been a real pleasure and we're very excited by what the Friends of the Earth are doing, and I hope our listeners are inspired to make contact with your local political representatives. They are there to speak your view and to represent you, and now is the time to encourage them to act on your behalf and your children's behalf. This is Planet Radio 88 FM. And you're listening to A Climate Affair, and I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon. If you're interested in attending a climate change discussion, there's going to be an event, The Changing Climate of Poverty, Climate Change and Development in the Asia-Pacific Region, with speakers Tim Costello, who's the CEO of World Vision, and many others. And the Friends of the Earth, Emma Brindle, will be speaking there, who we just had a great conversation with. It's going to be in the Tara Room of the Irish Club, which is 171 Elizabeth Street in the Brisbane city area. and it'll be 1:30 to 3 p.m. Thursday, the 26th of April. So that's coming up, Thursday, the 26th of April, if you're interested to find out more about the changing climate of poverty, climate change and development in the Asia-Pacific region. There's going to be a clean energy forum on Thursday the 19th of April, 6:30 for a 7 p.m. start in the Paddington Community Workers Centre, 2 La Trobe Terrace in Paddington, and that will be discussing clean energy in Brisbane. If you want more details, you can contact Friends of the Earth, emailing Emma Brindle. That's Emma, E-M-M-A dot Brindle, B-R-I-N-D-A-L at foe.org.au, FOE being Friends of the Earth. Well, as Queensland now brings in very tough water restrictions, wealthy homeowners who use large amounts of water could face fines of up to $5,000 under tough water restrictions to come into effect in drought-stricken southeast Queensland. As the state government attempts to secure water supply in the fast-growing region, Queensland Water Commission chairman has said that households that use more than 800 litres of water a day could have water restricted to their properties. It's the first time I've heard about the rich actually being penalised for excessive water consumption, and it seems like a fair way to go, to actually have some form of measure where a certain number of people have a certain amount of water requirements, and then people who have money should be really pressured into utilising that money for efficient devices and not able to just build as many bathrooms in their homes and have as many types of toilets and spas as they could desire. Because simply desire is not good enough these days. And apparently the final level 5 water restrictions that have just come into effect 2 days ago, they said the worst water abusers were usually from wealthy families on high incomes from that what they call the AB demographic, with large houses and a couple of children. About 110,000 people, or about 1 in 10 households in southeast Queensland, use 800 litres a day. It tends to be people in the higher income bracket who don't tend to pay that much attention to their water bill, and they think people will moderate their behaviour once it is brought to their attention. Heavy water users will not automatically face hefty fines, which have yet to be finalised by 12 councils in southeast Queensland, but will have the option to scale back their household consumption through filling out a water audit for the commission. If that failed, they faced a $150 fine for each offence, expected to be increased to a more meaningful fine. And persistent offenders could also have their water flow significantly cut. Well, it's interesting, you know, why not penalise people about water? What's the reluctance? I don't understand it, especially if we're all allowed to have the amount of water that we actually need. Why should we not be penalised? Why do people get penalised massive amounts for, you know, parking fines? I mean, you can get a parking or a speeding fine that's more than $150. Maybe not a parking fine, but definitely a speeding fine. And of course, that's human safety. But isn't it a human safety issue to protect our water, especially with people who are obviously using so much? Seems like poor double standards to me. Planet Radio 88 FM, you're listening to A Climate Affair. In more water news, there's two different things that have gone on the last week. One is the proposed Bribie Island desalination plant north of Brisbane, and the other is the idea of pumping water into southeast Queensland from New South Wales. Both of these plans, of course, have met with opposition politically, and they are relatively vague at the moment, but apparently the state government has done a report on a $3 billion desalination plant for Bribie Island, which would, if it did go ahead, secure the southeast Queensland's future water supply. But local councils are upset because they feel like they haven't been kept in the loop. Nevertheless, at this point, there hasn't been any precise environmental criticism or political opposition apart from a communication discussion. And in terms of the pipeline plan, the idea is that in rivers, the Clarence or Tweed rivers in northern New South Wales would pump water into the Logan River south of Brisbane. And the plan would be aimed at alleviating drought conditions in southeast Queensland, where, of course, we have become the first Australian capital city to move to level 5 water restrictions. Planet Radio 88 FM, you're listening to A Climate Affair, and I'm Kate Connery with you this afternoon. The environmental campaigner Al Gore hopes that the Live Earth concerts on July 7th will do for climate change awareness what Live Aid did for Africa. The former US Democratic presidential candidate is spearheading efforts to get the world of pop music to back his crusade to avert what he calls a planetary emergency. Apparently both Madonna and the Red Hot Chili Peppers have confirmed. The Live Earth concerts on July 7th will be the largest musical event in world history. Apparently there's going to be a series of concerts held across the world over a 24-hour period. There's going to be one in Johannesburg, London, New Jersey, Rio de Janeiro, Shanghai, Sydney and Tokyo. So Sydney for the Australians amongst us. And it'll be very similar model to the Anti-Poverty Live 8 gigs in 2005. Organisers said the concerts could be watched and heard by 2 billion people worldwide. And, you know, they hope to change public opinion, which is great, but is the concert system itself, let's hope that they're going to be carbon neutral or very substantially concerned about the environmental impact of the concerts themselves. Musicians have a difficult time reconciling all their busy travel with environmental concern, and perhaps concerts are not necessarily the best way to advocate an environmentally conservative message. Certainly, there's a handful of complaints with bloggers questioning whether pop stars and their taste for conspicuous consumption are the best advocates for cutting fossil fuel emissions. Yes, I wonder what Madonna's average carbon footprint is. Planet Radio 88 FM. Homeowners are setting new benchmarks by making their properties green and environmentally friendly. Australian homeowners are spending a fortune future-proofing their homes. Demand for grey water hoses, rainwater tanks, pumps, mulch, solar panels, and solar hot water systems has gone through the roof. And of course, some of the questions being asked are what are the value that these are going to add to your home? Within a decade, property that doesn't employ energy and water-saving devices will be viewed in the marketplace as second rate, and prices paid will reflect this difference. A year ago, no one was really talking about environmental components when they were buying a house. It wasn't in people's minds, but the drought has really focused people. And so far in Brisbane, the Brisbane City Council will not guarantee rebates for water tanks. They can't guarantee they're going to be able to pay for them past June of this year. The council currently offers rebates of up to $750, with an extra $100 available if the tank is connected to taps inside the home. But the Environment and Sustainability Chairwoman, Councillor Helen Abraham, says that more than 29,000 rebates have been approved this financial year, and that the program is well over budget. However, it is the most successful rebate program of its kind in Australia, which is just amazing. So good on Australians for getting out there and getting water tanks. But the question, of course, is does that actually add to the value of your home in the future? A survey of advertisements on realestateview.com.au shows the number of properties using phrases such as solar hot water, energy efficient or environmental has increased 300% in the last 4 years. But when you consider that only 120 listings used such phrases out of almost 45,000, it's clear that, you know, traditional stuff like off-street parking and so forth are much more marketable in real estate so far. But younger buyers are really interested in environmental performance. There's obviously room for people in real estate to consider the environmental impact of the property they're going to buy much more seriously. Certainly, I don't want to buy a house with an absolutely gorgeous garden that I'm not allowed to water in drought conditions because it doesn't supply its own water. It's time to start treating city properties the way a lot of farm properties are treated, where the ability to gain water from that property is a huge component of the marketability of the land. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. We have another guest on the show. We've got Bridget Brill, who's the Director of Greenhouse Friendly Team in the Australian Greenhouse Office, which is part of the Department of the Environment and Water Resources. Hi, are you there?
Hi, Kate. Yes, I am.
Great, Bridget. Great to have you with us. What on earth is Greenhouse Friendly?
Greenhouse Friendly. Well, Kate, Greenhouse Friendly is an Australian government program. And it's all about a couple of things. First, it's about reducing your emissions, and we have a household brochure called Cool It for those households that are interested, and a program for businesses called Challenge that help with the reduction of emissions. And then we offer an opportunity for businesses to offset the remainder and, if you like, go carbon neutral by purchasing abatement from projects that have been approved as providing a greenhouse benefit.
It's just amazing. This greenhouse stuff has become incredibly potent in the political environment in Australia. How long has Greenhouse Friendly been operating?
Greenhouse Friendly has actually been operating since 2001.
Wow.
So we were actually, if you like, the government program was ahead of its time, and essentially consumers, the market and business groups were not really ready for it in 2001. It's given us the added advantage of refining our program, making it user-friendly and streamlined for businesses to get on board. But we're only now seeing in the last 12 months a really large uptake in the level of interest in going carbon neutral and, more importantly, actually actively reducing your emissions.
It is incredible, isn't it? I mean, Planet Radio has been around for 10 years, but the world wasn't ready for us back then. They didn't know what an environmental radio station could possibly be.
Well, I can totally relate to that, Kate.
So what did you do before you came on with the carbon, the Greenhouse Friendly gang?
I've actually been working at the Australian Greenhouse Office for over 6 years. So I've been working in Greenhouse, primarily in international, until I came on board Greenhouse Friendly last year. And we've been working very hard to make Greenhouse Friendly, meeting international standards, ensuring that what people are purchasing when they purchase abatement is real, that the benefit that abatement is providing is an added greenhouse benefit, and that it's meeting all those international standards and rigour that we know Australian businesses and households want.
Absolutely. So maybe you could help us out a little bit. I mean, what sorts of activities qualify as carbon abatement schemes?
Right. It's a good question. Basically, carbon abatement is when you pay someone else to reduce your emissions. So providers sell abatement that reduce emissions or lock up carbon, and that could be from forestry activities, saving energy by recycling materials, composting, waste diversion, a generation of renewable energy, a whole host of things. The Australian government, through Greenhouse Friendly, ensures that abatement that's sold by these projects will help combat climate change and is calculated accurately and according to international standards. So there are a few things that you need to look for in terms of qualifying or ensuring what you're purchasing with carbon abatement is the right thing. And the first thing is to make sure that what you're getting is additional, so it's definitely providing a greenhouse benefit. It wasn't going to happen anyway without your support. That the abatement's been independently audited. So even with Friendly being a government program, we still insist that all our projects are independently audited by verifiers qualified in greenhouse calculation. And the third thing that businesses should look for is that the abatement's calculated and determined by internationally recognised methods and standards, so that what they're getting is a real reduction and they know how much that is.
It's quite incredible, the quantification on your website. I found this absolutely marvellous, that you could look and see exactly, you know, how many tonnes of CO2 were reduced by any particular project. And I was interested in all the different types you've got here. One of the ones that seems to release, to sort of save a lot of carbon, is called landfill gas projects.
Yep.
What are they in? I've no idea what they are.
Right, okay, well, gas flaring from landfill involves burning the methane that basically builds up from landfills and preventing it from entering the atmosphere. Burning the methane is a good way of reducing greenhouse emissions because methane has a high global warming potential. It has 21 times that of carbon dioxide. So many people, when they think about greenhouse, only think in terms of CO2,
mm-hmm.
when in actual fact, of course, As many of your listeners would already know, greenhouse gases are a component of six, and methane has huge global warming potential. So burning that off before it's released means that it's less harmful to the environment.
So what is released when we burn off methane then?
Right. Well, what happens is the methane is burnt rather than directly released into the atmosphere. In many of our projects, it's also captured rather than just burnt, and goes on to produce renewable energy.
So that's incredible. So it's a really win-win situation, renewable energy from these dump sites, really. That, I mean, it's sort of like, animals release a lot of methane.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it is exactly a win-win, and many of our projects are like that. Well, all of them. I mean, they have to be to meet those additional criteria, but they're producing a win for the environment that wouldn't have occurred otherwise unless they were doing it for the greenhouse benefit.
Yeah, so you guys are pretty serious. You're not taking in any greenwashing, which I think is a major concern by a lot of consumers, is they're worried that there are ads being sent out by companies with a sort of token environmental policy that really doesn't take seriously the full consequences of using energy.
Kate, that is just a really valid point, and it's important that listeners appreciate that reduction is really important, and there's lots of information on our website about reduction activities, and that when you're going carbon neutral or purchasing abatement, that you really know what you're buying and you're calculating your emissions accurately. And as an Australian government program operating at that federal level, it's important for us that we're, if you like, setting that benchmark.
Absolutely. One of the other projects you've got here is the conversion of coal and oil-fired boilers to natural gas.
Yeah.
So that's actually staying within some form of carbon cycle, isn't it, by using natural gas?
That's right, except what it's still doing is it's proven that it's beyond business as usual. It's not a normal activity for that sort of operation. So if it was normal, if lots and lots of similar plants were doing the same thing, then it wouldn't be eligible as an abatement project. But because this is exceptional, and you're right, they're still using natural gas, but it's a lesser greenhouse impact. So what they're doing is they're getting that benefit between using natural gas or using the other product, and it's the difference that's providing that greenhouse benefit and what generates the abatement. But that again, it's that whole additionality issue, making sure that the project you're purchasing is providing an additional greenhouse benefit that's beyond what's normal.
I see. So what's interesting also is that you're working not only with businesses that are trying to go carbon neutral or reduce their carbon footprint, but you're also supporting businesses that are offering these services. So what kind of criteria do you have for a business who says, I want to be part of your carbon abatement program?
Right. What we do for both sides of our program, the carbon neutrality and the abatement approval, is we have a team of staff here that work with the business and step them through the process. So if you want to become, if you have a project or an activity that you think is generating an additional greenhouse benefit, you get in touch with our office and we walk you through the criteria, which is essentially around calculating your emissions, putting in an emissions monitoring plan, and then getting that independently audited, ready for approval.
So there's quite a process. But now if I was one of these businesses and I went through that procedure, would I get money? Is that how it operates?
That's exactly right. What we do is we approve the project, and then as the project generates a greenhouse saving, the project owner puts in what we call abatement claims, and they get independently verified as well, independently audited, and they make a claim that we've saved, for instance, 100,000 tonnes in the last 12 months. They can then sell that 100,000 tonnes of carbon credits or abatement to the marketplace, to other participants in our program that are wanting to go carbon neutral and need to buy the abatement, or even we have many that are offsetting it against their own activities.
It's really incredible because a lot of people have talked about carbon credits in a very abstract fashion, and politically a lot of the opposition parties in power, and I certainly don't want to make this into this party versus that party, but people don't realise, as you say, you've been around for 5 years or more, I guess, more than that now, 6 or 7, and you're already doing a carbon credit program. It's already implemented in Australia right now.
That's right. I mean, it's a voluntary project-based scheme. So it operates in the voluntary market, but what we are doing, that's right, is creating abatement from project-based activities. So we're approving carbon credits from project-based activities that are meeting all the international benchmarks and standards that are being applied in other countries.
So is it the case that if I was a farmer and I was looking towards reducing my costs or making extra money, I could take ordinary farming activities and investigate things like methane capture and incorporating sort of these sorts of greenhouse gas saving projects and maybe make extra money that would offset the cost of setting up those projects?
Yeah, that's right. Certainly there's some really terrific potential for land-based activities, and obviously every project's different, but we're certainly working closely with the agriculture sector on areas like methane capture and potential projects around forestry activities in particular. And there are very strict guidelines around forestry activities, but we have about 6 in the pipeline currently. And we're really excited because, again, it gets back to that win-win where we're providing additional greenhouse benefits, but at the same time there's also biodiversity and land-based benefits as well, both for the farmers and for the land.
Absolutely. I mean, looking again at your actual projects, I mean, they're such good projects regardless of greenhouse emissions. For example, composting, I see here, is something you can waste aversion and aerobic digestion and compost, avoiding deforestation, so dealing with landfills, diverting waste from landfills, reclaiming recyclable material. I mean, if I was an individual, you know, I mean, you know, you've got kids who collect tin, aluminium cans and take them off to get their 5 cents a can or whatever. Yep. I mean, you know, you could have a group of people get together and go, well, let's go to the garbage, you know, and go through the garbage and make some money.
Let's create an abatement project. We've got SMRC, the Southern Metropolitan Regional Council in Western Australia. One of our abatement projects is a wonderful example of that. They have an additional compost measure where they collect from their households, and all the money that they're generating from that abatement as they sell the carbon credits is going back into making their households carbon neutral.
It's quite amazing.
So
I mean, it's
they're
very exciting.
Self-funding their greenhouse activities within their regional council facilities, and it's just terrific.
I mean, because money really speaks. People want to do things that help them financially because they've got kids and they want to make sure that they have a secure financial future. And you guys are really offering a fantastic way to do it. And businesses like, you know, that are high carbon users want to buy those credits.
Yeah, that's right. And we're about to launch in the coming months a new program particularly geared for small businesses and households, where small businesses and households will be able to go directly to our website, get lots of information about reduction, which will be interactive as they put in additional reduction measures, as well as an opportunity to go greenhouse friendly, carbon neutral.
That's terrific, because again, maybe some people can't get themselves into an organisation, but they'd like to know how this operates.
Exactly right, and we're certainly seeing a lot of small businesses that are seeing the benefits in improving their greenhouse credentials and their commitment towards mitigating climate change.
Fantastic. So what else should the public know about your program?
Well, they should look for the logo. We have a logo which I know is difficult to describe for radio. But
I can do it. It's a house. It looks like a house.
It's a green happy house. It's a happy house. And for instance, you can see that on Dulux paint, paints that are currently greenhouse friendly. Their Enviro2 and Aqua Enamel products have a happy house on their can, which means they're carbon neutral. We have a 1300 number, which is 1300 130 606, which will link you directly with a greenhouse-friendly project officer who will answer all your questions and step you through the process if you think it's for you. And our mailbox is greenhouse-friendly, all one word, at greenhouse.gov.au.
Fantastic. So good to have that information, and fantastic to speak with you today, Bridget.
Thanks for the opportunity, Kate.
Terrific. This is Planet Radio 88 FM. And now we're going to talk about green weddings to lighten the mood somewhat. So traditionally, weddings, of course, are activities that are hugely expensive, and with all things that are very expensive, likely to have an enormous environmental impact, at least in proportion to what the event is achieving. The trendiest weddings now are at least metaphorically green, as couples are seeking to reduce the impact of their nuptials on the environment. And that means everything from recycled wedding dresses and guests arriving by bicycle to homegrown flowers and locally produced food for the wedding buffet. And, you know, again, in the same way that a year ago people weren't thinking about these things, people weren't thinking a year ago about how green their house was, there was nothing at wedding shows either. Oh my goodness. I mean, the wedding industry is a huge industry. Billions and billions of dollars go into it. And last year there was nothing about eco weddings, but now specialist venues, products and services are being launched every week. And the contrast here is, of course, with the British celebrity Liz Hurley, who had an incredibly lavish wedding last month. You know, she's been criticised because her celebrations sort of broke all the green wedding rules, and some have dubbed it Liz Hurley's big, fat, not-so-green wedding. The wedding, which flew in dozens of guests to India from Britain for a series of parties, produced an estimated 200 tonnes of carbon emissions, more than the average couple produces in a decade. Whereas there's a whole bunch of things that people can do to make their wedding more environmentally friendly. One thing you can do is have the wedding and the reception very close by, like within walking distance of one another. It's often really easy to do that inside of cities. And as soon as you have location weddings that are a great distance away, you often need to get buses or transportation arrangements for all of your guests, which actually contribute more heavily to the carbon imprint than if you had it in already urban areas. Of course, some people want to get, you know, married in these wonderful natural environments, but actually by having that in natural environment, you might be creating a greater carbon imprint. Also, there's great websites where you can invite your wedding guests to donate to your favorite green charity instead of getting gifts that you don't need if you already have your toasters and so forth. Other things, of course, is wedding dresses themselves. Try eBay. I got my dress on eBay and it was a designer sample and it was so much fun and it was fine. You don't have to get a new wedding dress and they always alter those wedding dresses anyway. You'll always have to pay for alterations. Doesn't matter if you had it made to measure because they always alter it. So you might as well get a dress, a secondhand dress, and then spend the money on alterations and save the money from having to spend a big one. So one of the great things, of course, is whenever you incorporate these green measures, it usually has a beneficial effect on the price of the wedding. Even if you don't think of yourself as an environmentalist, you can have a green wedding and reduce your bottom line. You're listening to A Climate Affair. I'm Kate Conroy with you this evening, and I'm actually going to have a shortened show tonight because I've got some back problems, so I need to keep myself in bed and checked out. But if you're interested in our podcast, you can listen to A Climate Affair online anytime by going to aclimateaffair.livejournal.com to download the podcast of all of our shows, and you can subscribe to the RSS feed or subscribe via iTunes. And I hope you've had a great week. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM.